Hello and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is episode 161 and this is being recorded on the 14th of October.
The latest in the week we've ever done this, Pip.
Yes. But, and also the latest in time.
Inevitably, yes.
This is the oldest I've ever been while recording a podcast.
And for me, the smallest.
What does that mean?
I'm very slowly shrinking, Pip.
Oh,
okay. In the course of many years.
Well, that's a concern, but yeah. Possibly not one for a games podcast.
No.
Anyway, how are you? Oh, this is Chris Thurston.
No, you're Pip.
Oh, and I'm Pip, yes.
This has gone well.
Well, I just wanted another shot at getting the end bit right so that people could, you know, believe in me again.
Well, we'll see how that goes in an hour or so. So it's just us this week.
Yes.
Due to a series of absences and scheduling mishaps and illnesses and things, we've ended up A, recording on the same day that we would normally be launching this pod into the waiting hands of our listeners.
See, I'm not the only one who's got this weirdly.
Look, it's been a long week. But yes, also a two-hander, which has very rarely happened in the history of the pod. Have you and I done a two-hander before, Pip?
Yes, the Pipcast, on which you did a guest appearance through a phone call.
I remember very well doing that. Indeed.
You're lucky I didn't give you a West Country accent.
Like your impressions of everybody from anywhere.
Hello, I'm Danny Dyer.
No, you're not.
Anyway, what's new in video games?
Oh, I wish I'd checked.
Yeah, well.
You write video games news for a living, Pip.
I do, but
tell me, what are the news?
Well, this week has been League of Legends things for me, because Worlds has just transitioned from groups into the quarterfinals, which marks the beginning of the knockout stage. And also, Riot released their first board game. I don't know what that accent was either.
It was also Danny Dyer, I believe.
Well, maybe it was Phil Mitchell.
Where is East London, Pip?
I don't
know.
Is it
in Devon?
If you go far enough east, then yes.
That's true. Devon is just any direction sufficiently far.
Yeah, you go far enough and you're in Devon.
But the League of Legends board game actually does bring us on to something that's relevant to both of us.
Does it?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Because we have played that game a lot.
Yes.
For a review that we wrote.
We did. Sorry, I'm just trying to be helpful by agreeing with
this,
you.
This Gilbert and Sullivan call and response bit is going to go down a storm.
Well, it's that or I have to drink my awful wine that I made awful by adding the lackluster wine that's
been
in my room.
You can
room
do that. Or you could... We should talk about the League of Legends board game because it's tangentially relevant to PC gaming,
okay,
but quite interesting in and of itself.
Well, all right then.
You don't have to agree with me, Pip. You just have to go along with this.
Oh, sorry. I was trying to bring positivity to the proceedings.
Why don't we just explain what the game is before this continues?
Yes, it's a board game that involves programming little characters in mech costumes to move around a board and fulfill different objectives.
Mech costumes.
Mission. Well, I mean, you know, a costume is a thing that you wear on the outside of your body.
Yeah, but isn't it just a mech?
Well,
I think just in mechs. I hate to be get all semantic straight away, but that's what I have done it now.
But, I mean, like, it's a mech suit. Mm. Like, you can wear a business suit and that's still your costume.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. I
you
never thought of it that
way. You can wear a tracksuit and that's your costume.
I just,
people
for me,
would think that you were an athlete.
Yeah, for me, the word costume suggests the appearance of, but not actually.
Well, yes, I mean, it embodies imposter syndrome, really, doesn't it?
So you feel like...
In this modern world of ours.
Pippa, are you a yordle, lost in a mech suit?
I got that once when I was leaving Worlds last year. They had the quarterfinals in Wembley Stadium, or Wembley Arena, rather, and I... had a bunch of interviews afterwards, and so I was late leaving the venue, but obviously the winning team, I'd been interviewing them as well, so they were sort of still to leave, and so there was a cluster of fans waiting on the I guess the backstage entrance and exit to the building. And I left, and obviously there's like a bustle of kind of interest because it's like, oh, is it Faker? It's not Faker, it's just me. But then someone yelled out, it's a yodel! And I got like a little round of applause as I went down the little red carpet thing. Yodels are like little, I guess like goblin-y elf kind of creatures.
Gnome people.
That's the one, gnomes, yeah. Not elves, sorry. Goblin elves. Are the tall ones.
Goblin elves.
You know what I mean, anyway.
So when I heard that the League of Legends were doing a board game, I definitely didn't expect it to be what it is. And then from the interview you did with our 4RPS about this, I get the impression that this was actually just a really good idea for a game that someone at Riot happened to be carrying around with them,
well,
that they subsequently put League branding on.
Yeah, it's one of their... one of the team who sort of does that thing of being a developer no matter sort of which aspect of his life he's in, and came up with a bunch of games that, you know, would just be played with family or friends or whatever. And one of them involved using like programming. And I should say that the programming in the game isn't that kind of, oh, you too can learn programming and isn't this fun? And no, it's not fun. But this is more of a kind of, you've got a command line with six different slots and you put different cards in and then you just read it as a kind of, this thing happens and then the next thing happens and the next thing happens. It's not the kind of complexity in that sense that I sort of associate with running into a wall with computer programming and then just leaving.
There's nothing
the room.
In it that's conditional.
No.
So it's all then statements rather than if statements. It reminds me of, it's sort of like a turn-based co-op game about programming those, like, Roomba robot things you had in school. Did he have them?
Turtle.
Yes, the turtle.
The little triangle turtle with, yeah. Like, the basic, yeah.
Yeah, and you'd program it to, like, complete a maze or something.
We programmed ours to run round in circles and, like, there was no way of stopping it apart from to unplug it, so we just had to sort of leave that class with this turtle robot still going round in circles.
The Canterbury Singularity, they called it. But yeah, so it's that, but with a kind of, so a card draft element that determines what instructions you're going to program into your mech costumes command line. And then that's the sort of basic way of interacting with the board game, and that can be for two players or four players. But then you take these, you know, then you're, the reason you're doing this, that you're programming your mechs in order to complete missions that progress as part of a campaign. So it's a bit like, I guess, like Risk Legacy or something in that regard, where you're opening new mission packs every time you beat one and adding new elements to the game, and to the extent that you could even spoil stuff that comes up in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's great. It's really, really clever. And surprisingly, I think it's would scale very well with the amount of players. Like we've done the entire thing two player, and it's felt genuinely sort of like close fought and tense and interesting throughout. And every time we've beaten one of these challenges, it's felt like a victory.
Mm.
And something I really like about it as well is that, despite being a co-op game about making these decisions on the fly and building up these command lines, and there's all sorts of these complexities to how the cards interact and so on, it never feels quite like one person could play it for both players. I mean, you could play it that way if you wanted to, but I think sometimes there's a danger with co-op games that, you know, people micromanage each other and so on. But we've always seemed to feel like we're doing our own thing. And sort of whenever the card draft comes out, we both know what we'd like from it. We sort of negotiate for the best stuff and fill roles differently and stuff. It's very hard to describe, but genuinely a clever design that just happens to be put out by, you know, a huge video games company.
Mm. Yeah, I really like that it wasn't just like trying to make a lane pushing game work as a board game, you know, or just sort of saying, oh, hey, it's League of Legends themed thing, you know, insert themed thing here.
Yeah, it's not League of Legends Monopoly.
Or Frustration.
Mm.
I don't know if they skin up Frustration. for people.
It's also, I mean, it's also worth noting that, like, so this, we got this, we were sent a copy by Quinn from Shop and Sit Down for review.
Mm.
And it's a massive box, like a huge chest of a thing, which is absolutely, like, packed with, like, pieces in these sort of pre-cut trays that I had to store it all neatly afterwards. And it's incredibly lavish feeling, like, for what is a 65 quid now sold out, I believe, thing. Mm. You know, loads and loads and loads of pieces, just tons of stuff, all really high quality, all plastic rather than cardboard. Things that could be cardboard or could just be tokens have been sort of rendered properly in plastic. And it's incredibly full feeling. And sort of, I can imagine if you were used to the sort of value proposition of board games, picking it up and going, how the hell are they getting away with this? It feels like what happens when you apply big video games money to board games, which is kind of interesting because I think getting into board games this year has recalibrated my sense of what's expensive when it comes to a game or not. So suddenly a 65 quid board game is like, oh, that's not too bad, given, you know, what you get, right?
Mm.
Relative to a video game where 45 quid is considered expensive. Or in League's case, it's free. So it's sort of, it'll be interesting to see if it negotiates that path between being a product that will make board games people go, holy shit, that's a lot of stuff for relatively cheap compared to other games of this type. Whereas the people who like League of Legends will be like, 65 quid for what?
Yeah, that was definitely something that I noticed on the forums before release. I haven't checked in sort of since, and I assume that they won't have been shipped out yet. But there was a definite split between the reaction of the board games community sort of in general and the people who were maybe more familiar with video games side of things. And obviously that's not to say that there isn't crossover in those areas, because obviously a lot of people I know who play board games are also into games in general. But yeah, that did seem to be something of a split, I guess. But yeah, it was a really, really good experience actually, and I was really pleasantly surprised. Mm.
I think it's the most human Riot have ever felt to me as well. Because that can be a bit of a sort of, like many sort of California tech companies, relatively young tech companies, there's a, you know, a culture and an atmosphere around them and around League of Legends generally, for me at least, in my professional engagement with them, that's quite, not off-putting necessarily, but I find it hard to get a sense of people's real interests or real kind of personalities, because it often feels quite anonymous. Or at least very carefully image managed. Whereas this is sort of a strange, idiosyncratic product that certainly no one was asking them to make. No one was saying, make an interesting strategic co-op board game about programming that happens to be to take place in your MOBA universe.
Yeah, it's nice to see that the company has supported a thing that was a bit off the beaten track for them and was also, you know, a thing driven by the interests of its employees, you know, of people who sort of have this background in a way that isn't necessarily across the entire company, which is cool. And yeah, like I have quite a lot of contact with Riot, and I would say that, like, it's kind of interesting because I think it just depends who you talk to and from which department and stuff. Because, like, I've had some really sort of interesting open conversations about, like, design work and about, you know, sort of intentions behind things and things. And that's been really interesting. I think it's weird because it's the sort of community that is so huge at this point that, like, I think I sort of have it in a tiny micro way on, like, Twitter or something, where you're sort of so aware of maybe something you say being taken out of context or whatever. Like, I can't imagine what it's like working for someone where, like, people are emotionally invested in the things you do and you know that you can't please everybody. I can't imagine not going into, like, a weird place with that mentally, you know?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, but it just, you know, the way they communicate is so carefully controlled so much of the time, when it's not a Reddit disaster, this is a sort of pleasant thing, because it feels like, you know, it feels very genuine. We should also say that it's called Mechs versus Minions. Mm. We did maybe omit the name of the actual game. But most people will know it as that League of Legends board game, so it's fine that we called it that.
Well, I don't know whether they will, actually, because for me it was personally interesting that they didn't call it League of Legends the board game, because I think that it does speak to the fact that it isn't trying to imitate, you know, the actions that you'd get in a complicated game of interactions.
Yeah, it's laudably free of, like, it's, even though it probably will serve as a, you know, a marketing tool for League of Legends more broadly with a community that might not have encountered it, maybe. That doesn't feel that intentional, because that would be the other thing to worry about when a company does something like this, is like, to what extent is this a cynical marketing proposition? Really, it's not at all. It uses the characters in the world, but you could swap it out for any kind of happy, blizzardy, goblin-y, robot-y adventure place, which is what they're called.
I should have probably checked on the actual order page, because now I'm curious to know whether it shipped with any kind of, you know, here's a skin for a thing,
or here's an exclusive,
blah, blah, blah. Like, because at that point, it's like, oh, maybe it is an on-ramp for the game. But if it just ships as a self-contained product and people can explore if they want to, then that feels a very different proposition, I guess.
Yeah, just an interesting curio, like, very unlike anything else that from them, really. I mean, because also, you know, they are ultimately a one-game studio, right? Like, they were making a card game and that appears to have vanished into the ether. They were, you know, League of Legends is the thing Riot does. And so for them to come out with something this genuinely really tightly designed, very generous, very clever, genuinely, like, interesting to play over the course of a couple of evenings. You described it really well in the review as like a box set you watch with somebody, but also you fight.
Do you enjoy my next time on Mechs versus Minions?
Yeah, like the end of every session, read out the first page of the next mission just to give us a teaser of the...
And do the accent.
You say accents, Pip.
Yeah.
You mean fine. Universally, whatever it is you believe Danny Dyer to be from.
Anyway, moving that one along.
Yeah. But that's, so maybe, yeah, so obviously a bit of a tangent from PC gaming, but an interesting overlap, and probably the closest thing that we've been collectively playing over the last couple of weeks or so.
Yeah, I'd say that's reasonable.
What have you been playing on the computer?
Oh, well, I have been playing Sunless Sea, because the Submariner DLC came out this week, I think Tuesday maybe. And I've also been playing a little bit of Smash and Grab, which is like a multiplayer looter kind of...
Looter shooter?
Beat 'em up kind of thing. And I have played a bit of Farabelle, which is a turn-based strategy thing, but where you play from the end to the beginning rather than, so you start off in the final battle with your character like overpowered essentially, and then every time you complete a level you go back in time and you have to then level down, so you lose ability points to spend and things like that.
So when you say sort of turn-based strategy, what kind, like squad level, army level?
Like hexes and individuals that you control and move around. Cool. So far, like I've had like a preview build, so I think there's a more polished one that's been pushed out today actually, because it comes out or came out a couple of hours ago that I haven't had a chance to look at yet. But so it was very much like I had a squad of individuals that could then sort of trample about, and there's things like if you've got somebody who's mounted on a horse, if you move them three or more hexes in one direction, they charge, and so, you know, that affects their attacks.
Sounds a bit like bit of Fire Emblem-y.
Possibly, sort of, although I've not played that. Mm. So I think I'm... Because usually I really don't like turn-based, so I tend to... I think the last thing I played of that was Advance Wars on the DS, and even then, not very much. And I find that those things tend to get, you know, complicated or overwhelming really quickly. So maybe me starting at the end and being quite powerful is the better way of getting me into them. But that said, I've only played like two missions, so I have no idea how it works later on. And obviously it does run into those weird problems of, so you're supposed to be at the end of this battle and it's, you know, I would assume supposed to be a big deal and whatever else, but like, obviously it's also the tutorial.
Mm.
So...
Yeah, because obviously traditionally stories end at the end.
So, and there's like a time travel component with some of the characters, like they can reset your abilities to the beginning of a turn or whatever else.
And so is your character, or whoever you're kind of focusing on, are they experiencing it backwards?
So I think you are like maybe the king or maybe a high priestess or like, you know, some combination of the two. You're sort of experiencing it as, I guess, that faction, maybe.
Yeah.
But the one whose ability points you get to affect is the king guy.
Okay.
King
and, guy.
What, and so he has the power to do the turning back time within the individual levels, so he can like reset a minion to the previous turn, so it would have like, you know, so basically it can attack twice or move twice or, you know, all of those
kinds
of things.
Or find a place.
Well, and the High Priestess can like, she can do healing and things like that, but also she's the one that is more able to, like, I think she's the reason that it's going back in time through, you know, the bigger swathes of time. So it's, that's why you're going down a level, you're going back a whole battle kind of thing.
Mm.
I think, like, I'm not entirely clear on some of the specifics because obviously I've been sort of mooching around in it a bit, or you know, just trying to get to grips with my brain doing a turn-based strategy, which it, you know, those are muscles I haven't flexed in a very long time. Usually hex tiles have me screaming and running from the room.
Is there much of a sense of the stakes? That would seem to be one of the things you would lose when you were going backwards.
Well, see, there's like a story there, and this is the part where I'm sure people will take to Discord to complain about me not following the story very well. But I can't remember why. You know, I think I'm trying to get to the beginning to avoid the battle altogether.
That makes sense.
I think.
So you're trying to undo.
I think so.
Hmm.
But like I say, I'm not...
You just keep going backwards until it comes to diplomacy.
Yeah, I guess so. and obviously you'll be so low level at that point that you won't have many other options available to you.
Mm.
But yeah, it's one of those things where I've been sort of so trying to wrap my head again around various bits and pieces just because it's so unfamiliar that I've rather lost track of the parts where I was supposed to be reading.
Clever idea, though.
It's an interesting idea. Like, I'm curious to see how other people take to it, I think. Especially because I haven't got far enough in to have formed a definitive opinion, I think.
Mm. What's it called again?
Farabel. So, Farabel.
Okay. Sounds cool. Is it, like, lo-fi? Hi-fi?
It's kind of cartoony, kind of blocky, art style, which also I think made it feel a bit more approachable to me. Like, it's not like with, I don't know, I'm trying to think of other hex-based things and all I can think of is Civ, but it's not that level of complexity. It's very much a kind of, how do you thunk this goblin in the head enough times that it dies? And then its friends maybe show up, or maybe there's like a wizard goblin that can like throw things at you from quite far.
And you got to thunk him as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and a few of my people have died, and I'm not entirely sure if that has repercussions because obviously I'm going back in time.
Yeah.
So what,
presumably
do
you
I
get them back next mission?
Back?
Or so hang like... on. Yeah. So If you go,
so I'm not sure.
Can you lose somebody that you had in the previous mission? Because presumably then they were alive in the next mission.
Well, the thing is, I don't know, because I don't know whether these are individuals with persistent identities, if you see what I mean, or whether I just have a certain number of foot soldiers in every given thing.
Yeah, that seems
like I would assume that if the king, prince guy or whatever, and the priestess...
king, prince guy.
Well, I'm not entirely sure which title he has. Anyway, no, she's priestess, I think.
Priestess.
But I think if either of those died, I'd be screwed, because presumably those are the persistent characters, but I'm not sure about the, you know, the hoi polloi.
The disposable time-travelling hoi polloi.
Mm. Mm.
Speaking of stories...
Yes.
You've been playing Sunless Sea, which I know you dug into for the first time in order to get all the way through to the new expansion stuff.
I did.
You seem to be rather enjoying it.
I'm having a lovely time. Or as lovely a time as one can have in the uber-threatening sort of atmospheric but kind of creeping dread of the Untersee.
Mm. Given that I know that lore and stuff often doesn't do much for you or bypasses your brain entirely sometimes.
Hey, I remember things about stuff.
What's the main character in Mass Effect called?
Shepard.
Cool.
Captain Shepard.
Oh, no.
Commander Shepard?
Yeah.
King Shepard?
King Prince Shepard guy.
Hang on.
The
no,
princess
like,
priestess.
Because, no, she starts off as, like, not a commander, right? She then becomes like maybe a Spectre.
You're an ex. The ship's XO. I think it makes you a lieutenant commander. Anyway, sorry. That was cruel of me to put you on the spot.
But I got it right.
You did get it right. So that, it was in many ways just omnidirectionally cruel.
Yeah.
Cruel on myself, really. But nonetheless, so what I was going to get around to is
sorry, I don't know why I'm doing that.
It's the wine.
Yeah.
Gross. Has, you know, have fail better succeeded in building a world that sticks with you? Because I don't think it's your memory. I think it's the forgettableness of most video game stories.
They have, actually. And there are some... obviously, there are things that have stuck with me in that world in a way that don't in more passive things. And I think that might be because the game also involves a degree of repetition as well as the sort of distinctive... stories that accompany particular things. Like, you know, I kind of have particular associations of place or of story that accompany the various locations. And I think I wasn't expecting that to the degree that it's happened. Because I think looking at screenshots and having read sections of the stories, because I've been interested in it for a long time. It's more that I wasn't interested in the, you know, unforgivingness before I realized that you could just manually save and all you lose is an achievement. So I think I'd sort of done that thing of bashing my head against it, trying to get a bit too far too quickly because I didn't have the patience for it at that point in time. And then just sort of not really seeing the individual locations. But now, having booted it up, I'm in more of a forgiving brain space for repetition. And so you go out, you explore ports, you come back to London to hand in reports, and, you know, you start unlocking little things that you can do, maybe take a thing to a place, or, you know, you learn something and so you use that information almost as currency or as another type of resource. And so it means that rather than at the beginning where I assumed that the port reports were a way of mapping, they were actually a way of maintaining current information. And so as soon as I'd realised that, I was going out and revisiting these places again and again. And I think that really helps to bed them into your brain in terms of, A, where they are on your particular map, but also, B, was I doing A and B or was it 1 and 2?
I think it was A and B.
Okay, well, B. You also have this... some of the stories will change over time, and so you sort of pay attention to those. And also, some of them are so weird, they do stick with you. Mm. So there's like an entire island of just, you know, postmen and like, or post persons. But that makes it sound like they are sort of
like transhuman
dead. Or, you know, like, I'm just so post person.
That'd be an amazing name for, if you needed, like, you know, for an alternate name for like Deus Ex style transhumanism. Well, Adam Jensen, the ultimate postman.
I had the most San Francisco conversation I've ever had in an Uber with this guy who was sort of trying to, I guess, express a very San Francisco type of ennui, and he said that he was post-life. And I was just like, oh, for God's sake. So yeah, and on that island, you can sort of, one of the options in the text is you can go down to the shore, and the shore just has like all these undelivered letters like lapping onto the thing, and you can kind of collect them in your sack and take them to be sorted, and you know, all of those things. And it's just so lovely and weird. It's kind of almost in that Pratchett vein of sort of, I guess, well thought out weirdness that he had specifically as well in the, it's, I think it's a thing that I miss from some of his earlier work as well, because I think towards the later stuff, it was very much a kind of analog for the real world, and a lot of the fantasy edges felt like they kind of got sanded away a little bit.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
And so, it's like almost hearkening back to, you know, the first book where you got introduced to things like there being eight seasons and spindle winter was a thing, you know? Mm. And so I really like that. Yeah.
It feels like, yeah, everything in Failbetter's stuff, even when it's familiar, it has to have like an unexpected adjective attached to it.
Yes, definitely.
So,
but there's even just lovely touches on the sea, like I was, or the Z, I guess, when I was sailing into a little bit of fog of war just to see what was there while I was on my way to somewhere else, because I didn't really have the fuel to go far, but I just thought I'd go in a slightly wiggly line. And I found that instead of it just being normal sea surface, I guess, it was, there were a lot of lily pads all of a sudden. Mm. And that was just delightful. And, you know, it felt like a new thing that I'd found and a new place to be. And I think that's something that really doesn't come across in either in screenshots or in just seeing the text isolated from the experience, which is, but that's not to say it's perfect, because I was talking to Adam at RPS about this, and we were both saying that it, especially when you're traveling, it does this annoying thing of it takes up just enough of your brain that you can't concentrate on anything else, but not quite enough that you're entirely paying attention. And so you maybe get a bit antsy. You have to be in a very particular mood for it. Mm. Otherwise it doesn't quite scratch either itch. You can't listen to a podcast, but you also can't really sink yourself into it, because there are such long stretches between interactions sometimes.
Mm. So tell me about Submariner, the expansion.
So that is the thing where you open up a quest line and can essentially just kit out whatever ship you have, and it transfers once you've got that upgrade to anything you might buy later, to become able to go underneath the waves of where you are now. And so I unlocked that a couple of days ago now, properly on my actual save file. And it's kind of interesting because it adds a few other restrictions, so that it's not a place where you can just spend loads and loads of time down there. So you've got your sort of your normal restrictions in terms of, you know, how far you can stay away from port, essentially. Mm-hmm. But you also have this like an oxygen meter, so that you know how long you can stay underwater for. And so you sort of go down, you'll have a little look, maybe you won't see stuff, or maybe you'll see something that looks really interesting, but you won't have quite enough oxygen to stay down long enough to get to it. And I think there's an element of it not being supposed to be a welcoming place. Mm. So, you know, you're not supposed to be able to just make yourself at home down there. You can prolong things by finding, like, ports of a kind underneath the waves and sort of seeing what has happened to people who have gone down there, essentially. And there are, like, wrecks that you can encounter, and your little bat that you send out to find things becomes a little sonar system, which highlights things in blue.
You don't just drown
blue.
A bat.
No. And it sort of highlights things in blue so that you can see them and maybe head towards them or run the fuck away if you think they might be threatening. I found parking underwater quite difficult, but that's more because, you know how on the surface there's like a ring of light that you go into and press the button to activate the story component. In these, it's more like you go up to the front of the thing and a metal grill will raise and you'll have to sort of navigate to just in between that and stop. And I don't know whether it's because when I first encountered those, I was like not accustomed to the controls because I was playing out of context at that point with another person's save file. But it was, I found it a lot harder to do that as accurately, and I did scrape the side of my submarine a couple of times. So, yeah.
So is it, in terms of what it adds to the game, is it like a lot of new stories? Is it like a way of just augmenting your means of progression through the old From the Sea? Like, how does it all fit together?
I think it's, you know, and obviously I want to caveat this with the fact that I haven't had my submarine for very long, so I'm only just sort of piecing it together. Essentially, there are quest lines that kind of knit the above to the below.
Oh, okay.
And you can start sort of, maybe someone will want to go to a particular place, or, you know, you'll need information from above to take to bits below, that kind of thing. And some of it I haven't figured out yet because it involves, you know, I guess pushing through, or maybe I need to soup up my ship a bit or like push through a particular preconception that I have, because like there are a couple of things that I have the option to do, but I don't know whether I'm just going to die if I do them. And so there's things like that. I obviously it also just adds a lot more story. So I think it's also a kind of reward for the people who've maybe mined out the existing content. And, you know, and I think, although obviously I wouldn't know because I hadn't played it before, that also it brings some upgrades or some changes to the interfaces and things. But again, like I couldn't really judge that because I didn't get into it until I had access to the souped up thing. One thing I will say though is that I found myself a bit frustrated with I can't always tell whether I can dive or not, and so I'm wondering if I'm missing a thing. Like sometimes I'll press to dive and I can't, and it just says, you know, it's not deep enough here, and then you'll sort of get a bit further and you can suddenly dive there, but as far as I could see, nothing had changed. So I'm going to maybe see what other people say on that front, and maybe I was just missing a cue or something. And the other thing is there's no map of the under that I can find. Like, usually you'd press M to bring up your chart or whatever, and you'd see the places that you'd discovered in relation to everything else, obviously, as a chart or a map.
Yeah, that's maps.
Indeed. And so I was doing that while I was underneath, but it wasn't, you know, it was just showing me the surface map, and I don't know whether you're just supposed to remember where things were or whether that's a way of making it difficult. But I like that doesn't feel right to me. That feels like there needs to be a
At least a way to take off what you've seen.
Surely. Yeah, or even just to be able to revisit it if you've got a quest line, you know? So, yeah, those are a couple of the things that I'm finding a bit weird with it, and that make it feel not like a novelty, but not quite like an integral part of the game yet.
Hmm. How long did it take you to get to the new stuff from a fresh start?
Oh, Lord.
Is it quite deep in? Is it like end game?
Not end game. I mean, I found the port that I needed to start like building my submarine when I'd uncovered maybe a quarter of the map. But that's obviously what I mean when I say a quarter is I'd run quite a lot of missions. I had enough fuel to get to that port and back again, and I knew that my ship was sort of roughly able to, you know, deal with most opponents I might encounter along the way, either by running away or, you know, by killing the littler ones. And so, you know, that was it wasn't too bad, but it just I was using someone else's save file to explore it at first, just to let Adam and Graham know what it was like, you know, just in very sort of loose terms. And the reason that I had someone else's save file was because I was really struggling to sort of brute force it. It's not a thing that you can brute force if that's what you've come for. You have to get to grips with the rest of the game first. And I think that that's fair enough, but it is very much one of those DLCs that is for people who, you know, you need to have played the base game for a while before you get to that point. And the game sort of forces you to do that just by where it is and what you would need to have done to unlock it. But yeah, it's very much one of those rather than, oh, I'm tempted in by this specific thing. Where is it immediately?
Yeah, it's an enhancement rather than a new start or something like that.
Mm.
Is there combat under the sea?
Yeah.
Is it the same as is it bad?
Yeah, I would say so.
Is it crabs?
Yeah, although you can find bits of crabs and just loot them for supplies, which is, you know, that can be quite nice. Satisfying. You know,
finally.
Sort of feasting on those who would disobey you.
Jesus.
But yeah, so it's, you know, there are other things down there, but like, yeah, it is that.
More of the same.
As far as I've encountered, it's...
that's a shame.
It goes along that trajectory, really, which, yeah, is definitely not the most rewarding part of that particular game.
Definitely not.
So, yeah, I don't know if you can use flares underwater either.
No.
Maybe I should try, but mostly I've run away from everything because it had a lot more health than I did.
That is only right.
Ascend! Ascend!
What was the third game you mentioned, Pip? I can't remember.
I played Smash and Grab.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
How's that?
I played bits of it with Alice, and I did that thing of just going in completely cold, and I only realised a whole bunch of the stuff when we came to talk about it for an RPS chat that we did, when she was just like, oh, so how did you skill your squad? And I was like, well, I can skill my squad, what now? So what it is you are on a team and you have control of the main character, but then you also can equip like a lieutenant of some description. So they have like particular skills and particular perks that you can, you know, factor into how you want to play. Like some are healing, some are, you know, sort of throwing projectiles in from afar, some are sort of more about defensive play, some are, you know, super heavy on the attack kind of thing. And then you also have three sort of minions who sort of join in, and you can like add another level of customization to how you want to play through them. Like maybe they're better at raiding, maybe they're better at fighting, maybe they're, you know, that kind of thing. And what you do is you spawn onto this map and you are trying to get to, I think it's like $50,000 in terms of looted, ill-gotten gains, basically. And the way that you get that is shops will become available at different points during the game, and you can go and like smash the storefront in and then
and grab
all of the all of the loot, and you have to spend quite a while breaking into the store, and then it's like repeatedly pressing the right mouse button to grab the stuff. And so, you know, you can maybe capitalize on an enemy being distracted while they do that to come in and start punching them and hopefully take
it's adversarial with the other players.
Oh yeah, yeah, that's why you're on a team. Essentially there's a 3v3 element to it, and so everybody has one of these mini squads that they're leading around the map, and then there's three on the other side. Sorry, I should have been a bit clearer on that.
Because to me it sounded more like Payday initially, co-op thing.
And then like there will also be other bits on the map, like vending machines or whatever else that you can beat up for, you know, maybe a health boost or maybe an armor thing or maybe a speed boost or, you know, those kinds of things. Yeah. And some of the shops will be where you can change your weapon for something else. Mm. And there are also little crafting stations where if you've looted the right components, then you can soup up your stuff to do different things. Like maybe I really can't remember if I've imagined this, but you know, like I think I had a metal pipe or something, and I could change it so that it did damage that made someone bleed, so it was like, you know, kind of damage over time.
You put a nail in it,
I think. But I know you can also sort of change crossbows and, you know, like mess around with bits and pieces. So it's more about finding the right rhythm for when you attack, when you loot, when you have a chance to upgrade, when you might want to fall back, when you might want to sort of bait somebody into going for a juicy looking shop and then ambush them like with three of your gangs on one, or, you know, those kinds of things. And then towards the end, you get like two department stores on the opposite sides of the map opening up. And so you can kind of contest those as well if you haven't sort of screwed up by then. And killing other people means that you get a little fraction of their loot as well. So you can sort of try and keep them behind with
that. You respawn there, right?
Yeah, you do. And also there's like interesting fight mechanics in that there's a kind of rock, paper, scissors component where you can use like grabs and smashes and defense to, like, you know, one is strong against one of the others and it's weak against the remaining one. So there's like a little
rock,
cycle
paper,
of
paper, scissors sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's an element to like trying to read what your opponent is going to do. But I'm not very good at that, so I just tend to rush in and mash all of my buttons and hope
and
for the best, which is why I've ended up seeing quite a lot of the different types of death you can have. So yeah, there's that.
What types are there?
Well, I can't remember. There's a lot of different names for it. Like, I think I died from maybe contamination, and then there was a picture of somebody with an axe with, like, the axe seemed to be oozing poison. So I think that was like an upgrade.
It was the axe that killed you, really.
Well, indeed, but it was like, I'm guessing it was also the damage over time kind of component, or like
poorly from too much axe.
Yeah, or like I think I died from getting ripped or something, which obviously like isn't,
as in like,
you know,
you got swole.
I got too buff for I was too hench for my own good. No, I think there was like maybe a nail gun component to that one or something. But anyway, I'm really glad that Alice started asking those questions, because it made me realise that I'd been playing a character who absolutely does not fit any way that I like to play video games at all. I would have been far happier with this. Like, I saw that there was a kind of ranged damage dealer essentially, and that's far more my speed, or, you know, at a push, like the really hench melee guy who's really good at like pumping up his armor stat. So you know, but I was playing a really sort of frail melee dude, and I was just like, oh, this is like the worst of all of my skills.
That's not traditionally your comfort
zone. No, having to get right up in their faces, but also somehow be good at dodging. I was like, no.
All up in the face or not at all.
Yeah, it's like I have to be like right in there, but quite well protected, or quite far away and fast. So I've actually reskilled my squad to hopefully be a bit better at it next time. And I think it's having a free weekend this weekend, so I'm gonna see whether maybe that helps a bit with learning as I play, because trying against the AI wasn't great, you know. It wasn't enough of a challenge. But then playing against real people, like the only people who've gone into the early access for that game are obviously people who will put the effort in to get good at it, you know, or who are excited enough about that type of game that they want to get in on the ground floor. And so, you know, it was a choice between either an AI like walkover or an absolute pasting at the hands of real people. So it felt like there wasn't much scope for learning exactly what I was doing in either of those. So I'm kind of hoping that the free weekend maybe brings a bunch of people that I can spar with, you know, who are maybe just as clueless as I am, but that I can,
but slightly more so, which would be perfect.
Well, yeah, that would be brilliant, wouldn't it? But I'd, you know, at least even if they weren't, you know, I'd still maybe start being able to read things a bit better, because it wouldn't be people who've already worked out how to exploit all of those systems and who I don't seem to have enough time in a fight with that I can do stuff with that information.
Cool.
Thanks. How about you?
So I've had a bit of a quiet video gamesy week. I have played a fair bit of the old Dota 2, and I don't want to get into a big old Dota chat, but I will say that a recent series of updates to that game has obviously... It's obvious that Valve are trying to make it more accessible in a good way. They've restructured the tutorials.
Oh, I saw those. Oh, that looked really good. You get to play as three different characters.
They're not the new... I don't know if they're new tutorials. I think they've been in there since Reborn.
I think I haven't been to that page since...
Yeah.
Recently, because one of the things that they haven't done is made the menus more intuitive in terms of me finding out where the hell my stuff is.
Yeah, I think they've improved that quite a lot. Like, they've added, I mean, it's a giant button that says learn on it.
Yeah, but when I was trying to find where the hell my autumn terrain was, I couldn't find that, so I just clicked everything.
They added a button that takes you directly to new items, but it's not necessarily obvious that that's what it is.
No.
It's the armory button in the top right. It just takes you directly to the most recent thing you got.
But it didn't. It just showed me all of the treasures that I could start opening. And I was like, but I'm not interested. I want my terrain.
I'll show you where it is later. Anyway.
I don't believe you're telling me the truth. Anyway.
Well, that's for you to believe.
I will.
But they've also, so they've refreshed the tutorials and things, and they've also started to implement new sort of in-game UI elements to make certain things a little bit clearer. The most recent one is stun duration. You now have a little circular indicator that tells you who has stunned you and for how long. It's little stuff, but they, you know, the game had felt done for a while, and now they're obviously making a renewed effort to make it something you can get into. Not really sure what prompted that. Maybe it's just the thing they want to start working on now that it's almost roster complete and stuff like that. So all I will say on that subject is, if you are curious about the game and you have failed to click with it in the past, or you haven't tried it, then I think, I mean, it is always the best possible time to try Dota, because it just gets better. But
you're like the Pied Piper of Dota.
It is the best computer game. So yeah.
Are you trying to do the thing that I'm hoping the free weekend will do for Smash and Grab, which is get like some nub-nubs in there so that you can...
So I can make a smurf. No. It just, you know, it struck me that these changes are being made, and perhaps the game's got such a reputation for being unassailable that people would not necessarily think that it was getting more accessible over time. But I genuinely think it is. It's still, you know, the most complicated thing this side of, like, being genuinely good at Kerbal Space Program or something. But, you know, it's still the best. The other thing I've done is I've played and completed Dishonored again.
Why?
Because it's, probably the best game. All the good games begin with D, Pip. That's what we're talking about.
But that wasn't... I didn't mean it in that confrontational way. I was wondering if you would start talking about your relationship with Thing, and then maybe the excitement that you have towards Dishonored 2.
Well,
or
no,
maybe
I was getting there. Just in my own circuitous way.
Circuitous?
Is that how you pronounce that word?
Circuitous.
I thought there was an extra T. Anyway. well, that's rather thrown me. So So no, I have replayed it because I am very, very excited about Dishonored 2, and I wanted to replay it and particularly replay the DLC because it looks from the trailers that the DLC is going to be pretty important. Mm-hmm. I've only just finished
the Knife of Stonewall,
the Knife of Dunwall, and the Brigmore Witches.
Okay.
I also just wanted to replay the entire thing with the kind of overall aim that I would do a playthrough that made all of the decisions that are now canon, because it doesn't import a save. It knows there is a particular way that the story of Dishonored 1 played out.
Does that hurt your heart?
No.
But you're the sort of person who has a very specific playthrough for particular games, and you have what you...
More so for games that promise that in the first place, like RPGs. Less so for games that have... that aren't really necessarily about the choices you make in quite the same way.
But I would have said that Dishonored was entirely about that. You know, like, it's about how you approach the
problems.
Yes,
it's about the
right?
details of how you solve problems, but to be honest, you make very few plot decisions in Dishonored until the very end of the game. In fact, it's only your chaos rating across the course of the entire game that really affects the story. There's one or two. Because more often than not, like, it bends over backwards to give you a non-lethal way of disposing of most of your assassination targets. But by necessity of the plot, almost all of those are like, this person won't be killed, but you will never see them again. Like, it gives you a billion ways to do everything. You have choices in that regard, which are choices you don't have in Mass Effect. You can't, quietly subdue everybody in that game.
Mm.
But in terms of the plot decisions, no. The decisions you make in terms of killing people or sparing them don't meaningfully change the story in Dishonored 1. So it doesn't bother me so much that there is a canon outcome, partly because, one of the endings leaves no room for a sequel. Like, if they want to have a sequel where, so spoilers for Dishonored, which is, now a 4-year-old game, but, there's a sequel where they want you to be able to play as Emily, the Empress, and as Corvo, her father / bodyguard, alternately, or, pick one at the start to play as.
Mm.
Both of those characters can die in Dishonored 1. So they sort of needed to lock down an ending where that doesn't happen,
I guess so. I think I was more thinking along the lines of, if I wanted someone dead in Dishonored, they would be dead. Like, yeah. I want them to stay dead. They were dead for a reason.
Well, yeah, so I think there's that. So the thing that's the things that I knew were confirmed were that Corvo spared the High Overseer, which is the guy you can brand him with the Heretic's Mark rather than kill him, which has him exiled.
What did I do?
You probably killed him. Yeah. You tend to kill everyone in every level.
Yeah.
It's
just to make sure, really.
The one that's the trickiest, because it's the one that's the least obvious to do, is sparing Dowd, who is the Empress's assassin, the man who kills the Empress at the beginning. Because when you go through his section later in the game, all you need to do is get his key to get out.
Okay.
And if you do that, you can either choke him out or you can just sneak past him and get the key. If you do that, there is an achievement for being merciful.
Right.
And it tries to seed that decision, because as you get closer to him, you find you can hear him talking if you're fast enough, or you can find his diary and stuff, and it reveals that he actually deeply regrets killing the Empress, and that he has an internal life all of his own. So you might decide to spare him based on that.
I mean, if ifs and buts were candy and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas, as the saying goes.
That's true, but that's not necessarily a reason to knife a man to death.
You say potato, I say potato.
There's no knife.
That's not how that goes. It's tomatoes, isn't it?
Anyway. No one says potato. Not even Danny Dyer, Pip.
Oh, potato. No, that's not. Hang on.
Was that Yoda?
No, it's my other voice. It's my other,
Yeah, because there's West Country and... What's this one?
Yeah. Is that's Obi-Wan's voice, isn't it?
No,
and
that
Luke
was,
and
yeah, that was almost
of them,
all of the characters
really.
In Star Wars.
Yeah.
You can change your mind. But I think it's, and this is, I know nothing about the plot for Dishonored 2 rather than the basics, so hopefully it's not a spoiler. I think it's the canon outcome is that Dowd was spared by Corvo.
Huh.
Which also, there was already a weird sort of two competing timelines thing in that you play as Dowd in the DLC, and that can go a certain way based on how you play as Dowd. And so knowing whether he survived or not it basically implies how both of them played. But basically, so, but that was my guiding thing, was to go through and try and recreate all those decisions just so I had a playthrough where that stuff happened. There's still plenty of room to do it your own way, but it sort of implies that you need to do a low chaos playthrough, so pretty stealthy, pretty non-lethal.
No, whatever.
And you can only kill certain people. So I might have done some things that clash with it, but not others. But the thing that struck me this time, so I love that game. I think it's genuinely brilliant and not necessarily ahead of its time, because it's a throwback in some ways, despite, you know, a few brilliant innovative decisions. And it's easy to focus, and you're probably rightly to focus on praising it for the same things people often focus on, which is some individual standout missions. Particularly in the first half of the game, we have great individual, wonderfully crafted kind of stealth assassination challenges.
The party.
The party is amazing. Everyone always, yeah, Lady Ball's party is always the one people go to when they want to talk about how brilliantly designed that game is. Mm. Down to the random assignment of the target and stuff like that. That's great. There's, and then, you know, the art style and the world and how sort of original it feels, and the kind of extraordinary artistic direction that enabled that, and their preference for sourcing their reference materials from history and traditional art rather than from games and pop culture. So even though it has steampunk elements, it's not really steampunk and all this stuff. That's all great. The thing that really stood out to me this time around, and I would stress this is like, I've played 200 or so hours of that game.
Wow.
Over a couple of years. Like I've played it a lot. And I feel like I know it backwards now, to the point where it was nice this time, not pretending it was going to be a challenge, just knowing exactly how each mission works and being able to kind of manipulate it, do things my own way a bit, try and sort of stage things in a dramatic way. The thing that stood out to me this time around is how many small things they got right. And this is what bodes well for the sequel, I think, because when I went to see them in France, I had an interesting conversation about how many things they felt like they got wrong in the first game, like little interactions that were slightly off and stuff like that. But actually, I think more than any other studio I can think of in the business, they are so good at figuring out what needs to change to make each individual interaction just like a little bit better than it could be to be fine. And there are examples of this all over the game. And I think it's, you know, it's the thing that separates a really, what would have been a really good game from a classic is little things. Like if you, and it's little things every player will notice, but you can play 200 hours of the game as I did and not really stop to kind of put it all together in your head and try and think about the creative process that leads, especially people making all these decisions. So if you point blink at a flat surface, you'll obviously see the height of the blink. If you put it at the max distance for blink, you'll see it hover above the ground at the point, the furthest point that you can get to. And if you point the blink cursor at the edge of a ledge that you can climb, it turns into arrows indicating that when you blink to that location, you will also mantle it. And this is completely subtly delivered information, but it enables the kind of fluidity of movement that makes the game really good. And other things like, you, when you slide into somebody, you kick them, which is not really broadcast anywhere, but it has a meaningful impact on how you can fight, because you can slide under bullets and kick people. You can still like access the like stealth takedown parts of enemies under circumstances where in other games they would probably be decided that because the enemy had been alerted, it had been shut off. So the moment someone sees you, they're surprised. And during that fraction of a second where they're reacting, but not haven't like drawn their sword yet, or even sometimes afterwards, you've got loads of options using time stop and blink and stuff to get them into the kill zone where you take them down rather than just hit them with the sword. And it's all these tiny little beautifully calibrated windows of opportunity. And that's how I think I would describe that entire game, particularly, and you don't really see this if you stealth everything. You see this when you start fighting. It's a game of really consistently and elegantly implemented windows of opportunity. So, and that even comes down to the fact that like a guard's sword can collide with the environment and sort of prang off. So not only can it collide with other guards and potentially kill them, but they'll try and avoid that. But if you're fighting like a right-handed man in a corridor, if you, you know, go to his right, then there's a good chance the sword will sort of prang off the wall and then you can stab him in the face. It's all the means to stabbing someone in the face at the end of the day. But I don't know how insightful that is given how much has been written about that game over time, but you know, I know there are people, because if you want to beat Dishonored really quickly, just run through every level, shoot the person you meant to shoot, and just keep running, because no one can really catch up with you, you're so fast. And I know there are people who played it like a shooter, or people like you, Pip, who played it like a stealth game for a bit and then killed everybody.
That was only because they started it.
They did start it, yeah.
I mean, if they'd carried on pretending I wasn't there, then everyone would still be alive. But they chose...
Hide and seek goes horribly wrong.
To break the illusion that I was in any way stealthy. So in a way, they really only got themselves to blame for this one.
Yeah, I'm not sure that would stand up in court, but sure.
Well, they haven't caught me yet, so...
Indeed, so yeah. but like... I think even if that game was a shooter, even if it was, or like a sword fighting action game with shooting bits and magic powers and stuff, if you play it as an action game, I still think it's genuinely a great one. Like, I haven't played Mankind Divided yet, so I'd love to see if Deus Ex had reached the same level. But, and obviously Deus Ex's combat improved tremendously since how totally rubbish it was in the first game. But, it's genuinely impressive, and I can't wait to see what they have managed to do with 4 years to iterate on the same idea. Mm. But also, given that Arkane are also the studio that made Dark Messiah: Might and Magic, which was like the best first person sword fighting, kicking people off stuff game ever made at that time. I do wonder, like, who else in first person actiony things is going to start really getting this right? Because Wolfenstein had it to a degree. Bulletstorm had it to a degree. Looks like Shadow Warrior might have it to a degree. But Dishonored puts the whole thing together and then sticks that inside an immersive sim. And that's why it's my favourite and I love it very much.
It's not your favourite though, is it?
Well, I mean, you're making me choose now. Like, okay. So, of all the games I like, they begin with D.
Yeah.
It's in the top three.
Sure. Fine. Shall we do questions from the questions?
Shall we?
Yes. That's disgusting.
I feel a bit gross. I have a sniffly nose.
It's because the wine.
Yeah. It's turned me into a ruddy-cheeked country gent like Danny Dyer.
That's what happens when something lives behind the printer for 6 months.
Oh, God.
I was hoping it would have turned into sherry, but no.
It's not how that works.
No. Well, it's how my Oscars wine worked.
Let's not get into this now.
No. What are the questions? Who's asked what?
Duncan Peel writes...
Hello.
Dear Crate and Quentulous Quasgar Mountains, long-time listener, first-time caller. My girlfriend has always resolutely held out that she's just not into games, and despite my best efforts, has shown little interest in anything other than The Sims and whatever soul-sucking king game is currently at the top of the App Store charts. Recently, however, she's been into a free-to-play Mean Girls simulator, obviously captured by the drama, although disappointed at having to make do with the inferior outfit to wear to prom that doesn't involve in-app purchases. Having spotted a possible opening, I quickly searched for Creighton Crowbar's favourite soap opera sim, Mask, but in vain. Am I spelling this right? He spells it both as in mask, as in, like, masquerade, and mask, as in, on your face.
I think it's M-A-S-Q.
Yes, it is. It's M-A-S-Q, but no E, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is this even the correct name? Having heard it spoken many times, but never having seen it written, and I found myself totally incapable of finding it. I'll try and put a link in the show notes to help you out. In addition to this, what other games could you suggest in this vein? I hope to change her perception of games as a collection of Mario or COD-alikes. I've thought of Gone Home as a possibility, though I worry that its subtlety and storytelling may lack the immediate hook that I think is needed. Any assistance would be greatly appreciated. Jeff. No, Duncan.
Wait, that's not Jeff.
Duncan, sorry. Jeff is the next person.
Oh.
Spoilers.
You're already on to the next one.
I've just gone from Duncan to Jeff.
Insatiable.
Insatiable. Can't get enough. Anyway.
Yes.
Adventure games that might be good.
Life is Strange.
This is a good time to bring up that game again.
Especially if, like, there's a kind of element of school soap opera kind of enjoyment already there. Like, because obviously it deals in teen drama as yep. much as anything else. And so I think it's also a good game to play with other people, because you can maybe talk about the choices that you want to make as you're playing, or, you know, sit with somebody while they do the controller bits if you're not comfy with those.
Yeah.
And in a similar train of thought, I'd maybe Oxenfree. Mm. It's a kind of, there's an element of sort of sci-fi-ness to it, but it's also teens on a beach drinking thing it starts off with. So, you know, and there's some choice-based bits and bobs there.
Mm. Those are both very good choices.
Mm.
I mean, if Gone Home is not necessarily, I think you have to be a little bit game literate to get the most out of Gone Home, simply because you need to be comfortable.
I think you have to be able to, like, yeah, and to sort of sink into that space in a way that implies a certain familiarity with the medium.
Yeah. If she's not totally averse to the Archers, then Everyone's Gone to the Rapture is not a terrible choice, because it is quite passive, but it's a lot more in your face with the drama, because you have the yellow glowing ball that takes you to radio plays.
Mm.
And you can listen to the story unfold around you. And
we played
beautiful.
That together on the sofa on the PS4 before it came to PC, actually.
Yeah, and that was quite... I think we...
That was nice.
We made the mistake of trying to do it all in one session, because I went into it thinking that it was going to be a, like, two-hour sort of movie-length thing, and it's actually a little bit longer than that. And I think if you start to rush, it gets a lot worse.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing to peg over slowly. But, you know, again, it's good. It's decent proof that there are lots of different strings in that game bow.
But
I think Life is Strange is the best choice here. It's the best overlap of subject matter, and it's punchy as well. It starts with big drams,
and it's episodic, so, you know, you can sort of see how it's going after an episode, or maybe spend an evening on an episode and then sort of move on when you've got the chance. It's kind of that box set element to it, you know.
And even though people maybe would say that they're a bit, the later Telltale games are a bit rubs. If there is a particular, given that they have just taken that original Walking Dead formula and spread it liberally all over every other TV series that they can find. If she is a fan of Game of Thrones, or I guess Batman is the most recent one.
Basically, or anything that they've been.
Yeah, any of those settings. They're not terrible. They're not, a lot of them aren't great, but they are at least sort of, or maybe something like The Wolf Among Us as well. Mm. You know, there's a lot of heavy story driven games, but that don't necessarily require a lot of sitting reading off a monitor or anything like that. The stuff you can sit around a TV and play on a big screen and kind of almost play as an interactive TV show. So, yeah. But basically the answer is Life is Strange and all of these other things we've said. But mostly Life is Strange.
Let us know how you get on.
Sorry for spoiling this already, but Jeff is next.
Oh.
It's Jeff. Jeff actually sent his question as an audio file as well, which we've never done before. Ooh. So I'm just going to read it out, because the thought of that frightens me.
What, the editing?
Yeah, I just have to do like 5 minutes of extra editing. And... frankly, I'm a lazy man.
Well.
Who's already late enough with this podcast as it is.
I see. Fair enough. Maybe in the future we'll work.
But thank you for the additional effort, Jeff. It is notable that no one else has ever done that. Step it up, every other questioner in the 161 episodes of this podcast.
What, even though you've just said that you won't be using the sound files?
Yeah. I don't make the rules, except I do. And they're inconsistent and frustrating.
So what does Jeff want to
Hello,
know?
He says. Hello, Daybreak and Freight Car. This is Jeff from Nova Scotia,
Hello.
Canada. I spent the summer enjoying Rust and its unique experience. It's the only game I've played that lets me feel like I truly don't belong in someone else's home. Likewise, I feel distressed when someone invades the space I've created. What games have you experienced that deal with invasiveness in meaningful ways? Thank you for your time, Jeff. I've got a few answers to this, because I think it's an interesting subject, actually. And, you know, I think the sense of the sort of sanctity of spaces is something that games often don't do at all, because if you play like a traditional JRPG where you can run, or like Zelda where you can run into everybody's house and take all their money and leave, and everyone's just like, cool, bye. And then obviously, you know, there are games about, you know, breaking into places and crimes and stuff, but they don't tend to necessarily nail it. And indeed, most stealth games, the places you're invading are military installations or fortresses and stuff.
Or just offices.
Yeah, or like, you know, cyberpunk megacorps that, you know, have sort of deserve it. This, I think, was one of the things, that sense of being an intruder was one of the things that made Thief special. Because you weren't, you know, even though you're the hero, I guess, in Thief, and you do good hero things from time to time, those stories start out with you're just a thief, you're just in someone's house nicking their stuff, and that's always been, and you're not particularly powerful, and you're not there to kill people. You know, if you start throwing a sword around, that's a different crime or entirely. You become murderer, and the game isn't called murderer, it's called Thief. So I think that sort of lends itself to the sense of being an intruder. And actually, that's In fact, the most recent Thief game, the one that is otherwise not great, has some really good ideas with regards to that stuff. The very first mission sees you enter someone's house to nick stuff, and they're just asleep in a chair, and it's a simple stealth thing. It's basically a tutorial, but you have that sense of slipping around the room, trying to, take all of their possessions without waking them up. And then there's a little thing it teaches you that you're swoop move where you can kind of glide from cover to cover under cover of darkness doesn't work, and in fact agitates people's pet birds. So if someone has a pet bird in a cage and you catch an eye on that and the bird is asleep, you've got to be careful to slip by it slowly. And using sort of little domestic details like that rather than, you know, some sort of security system, so sells the idea that you're in somebody's space.
Is that like how cats can detect ghosts?
Yeah, cool. Exactly. Birds can detect thieves. That's how it works.
Yeah.
In terms of games that where you feel the pressure of being intruded upon,
could you steal the bird?
No.
Oh.
No, that's a good question. No, you can only steal the things that the game lets you steal, which is one of its weaknesses. In terms of the feeling being intruded on, I was going to mention Alien Isolation. Comes up, I guess, a bunch, obviously, but because of the non-scripted nature of the alien, when it shows up, it always feels like an intruder, because it is. But it's not just, you know, it's not part of the game world in the same way the scripted enemy bursting out of a cupboard is. Similarly, what was I going to say that was similar to that? Oh, Dark Souls. A bit different in angle, but everyone in the dog knows that this can happen now, but the unadvertised nature of that game's PvP system, where other players can just suddenly be in your world and murder you and run off again, is terrifying and is a brilliant idea and, you know, helps to sort of, make what would otherwise be a routine interaction of the game, you'd probably just call it PvP, turns it into an actual feeling that you're under a special kind of danger, particularly in a game that's already pretty hostile towards you.
I think in terms of that, like the fact that they might help or hinder you is another part of that. Like they might,
in Dark Souls, they're always either going to kill you or help you, depending on what color they are.
Oh, okay.
They're either a dark spirit or they're not. And if they're a dark spirit, I mean, I suppose they might not be dicks, but
because I'm not into Dark Souls and so haven't got far enough into it that's even come up, but like the impression that I'd had from you talking about it was that sometimes people turn up and help you and sometimes they don't, and so for me, like, I was interpreting that as a lottery almost, of like, oh, there's a person, what
so actually
do I do?
that's not that untrue of the later games. So there are covenants which players join, and that allows you to do different things, and like, it was a bit more binary in the earlier Dark Souls games. Like, someone's either, like, they show up, they're glowing, they're gold, they're going to help you, their objective is to help you, they're not going to fuck you over. Or they are red and scary looking and they're going to kill you, and so there's not really ambiguity there. But later on, there are covenants that could go either way.
Mm.
And that does create a sort of a bit more ambiguity. but I don't think it feels intrusive, because I think by the later games, the fact that this multiplayer component is a part of the game is a lot more obvious. Like, there's loads of these covenants and you find them all the time, and it feels more like a back of the box feature, whereas the sort of surprise, there's another player in your game and they're here to murder you, in the first Dark Souls, that was more, that's what I mean by feeling intrusive.
Mm-hmm.
I think for something to feel intrusive in a game, it needs to somehow feel like it's violated, like, the structure of the game itself. Like, it's, you know, even the developers haven't, you know, like a creepypasta, you know, like those stupid internet stories about, like, haunted Zelda cartridges and stuff. It's always like, the game itself is alive!
Mm.
I'm trying to think. There's always something weird in Star Wars Galaxies where you'd go to someone's player-built house to use their shop, which would be like a vendor they'd set up in their house. And you could go into their house just to use the vendor, and you weren't allowed to interact with anything else. But then they'd, like, come home, like, halfway to use their crafting station or something. There's always something slightly weird about being stood in someone's living room, talking to the NPC they'd created. And, like, do you say hello? Do you not say hello? It's a very different sense of being an intruder.
Yeah.
But it was more like you just sort of, like, someone had just walked in on you standing in their living room talking to their nan or something.
Yeah.
That was weird.
Because, like, yeah, I wasn't interpreting it as a creepypasta thing. I was interpreting the intrusiveness more as a kind of awkwardness almost, or being made to feel not at home suddenly.
Mm.
And so, like, at the risk of it being kind of slightly outside the remit of the question, or maybe a bit too heavy, that's why I don't use voice chat, is because that's the thing that has the power to make me feel instantly not at home in gaming environments, is the unwanted attention that comes with having a female voice.
Mm.
Like, you know, or being involved in other people's streams and things, just because it gets extra attention that is really not wanted. I mean, like, stupidly, we were playing Intruder. yeah. And, you know, that game just has, like, public voice if you are on the channel, because that's how it works. Like, it's supposed to be that you literally have to talk more softly, because otherwise the enemies can then hear you. It has kind of context sensitive volume that broadcasts to both teams. And you and I were playing, I believe, with friends, and some stranger joined the chat channel, heard me, and were like, oh my god, there's a chick in here! And I was like, instantly, I felt singled out, and like, I suddenly wasn't at home having fun with my friends anymore.
Mm.
It was instantly like, not only am I not in the game anymore, I'm also, I just don't want to be here, because it's now a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's an interesting point generally that, like, this sort of games like Rust, I mean, Rust, I think, has female characters now, but for a long time it was the game of bald men with their dicks out chasing each other around the wilderness with sticks. Is, you know, they offer a sort of, you know, a safe way to be threatened by other people, to have, you know, to, you know, Rust, it's a survival game, and you can, it's a controlled environment in which to try and build something up and then have it destroyed by somebody else, or to have your, you know, literally your personal space invaded by somebody else.
Mm.
But I can completely understand the reasons that that might not be, you know, just a, you know, fun game idea if, you know, your experience of online life is that you have to avoid using your voice or revealing who you really are for the actual pressure that gets put on people.
Mm. I think it's more just that, like, that's where I went to with the intruder thing, because those are the times when I felt not at home. It's like, I think maybe because that is a thing that happens, everything else feels slightly less, because the other thing, like the voice thing, is something that feels like it links, or it stretches out of the computer and into my brain in a different way, or into my personal space in a very different way. Whereas, you know, if it's just somebody trashing the car that I happen to have in GTA or whatever, like, whether that's friends or strangers, like, it's it's still very much confined to online. I think I'm far more sort of fearful, or at least wary of the parts where more worrisome aspects of gaming might bleed into other aspects of your life.
Mm. Yeah, when I was talking about, you know, this sense of invasiveness is effective when the game can feel like it's sort of alive or acting outside of the, you know, authorized parameters set for it by its developers, or just gives the impression of that. That sort of assumes that the game is not normally in any other way potentially a threat.
Mm.
And actually, if, you know, I guess the situation you're describing is one where actually, no, the game can be. The game can put you in a situation where you feel uncomfortable or at risk.
Mm.
And that, yeah, I guess you're right. That does totally undermine, or like, I guess neutralize what would otherwise be an effective feeling of threat through other means.
Mm. Yeah, I guess it's just a different continuum. Like, it puts certain things further towards the neutral end.
Yeah. Yeah, I suppose that's the other way of saying what I was going to say, was that the sort of the techniques or the ideas that I've described presuppose that you are by default completely at home, and have been made to feel completely at home in a game based on who it assumes you are.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we've answered that one. Comprehensively.
Mike writes, "Dear Crep and Rhubarb, on a normal work day, I have two shifts.
That sounds really nice, by the way.
Crap and rhubarb.
Yeah.
Mm. The usual 9-to-5 day job and the occasional freelance work that goes late into the night. The freelance work usually starts about 6, which means I have just about an hour to prep and consume my dinner while also getting in my gaming needs before getting back to work. My library of games used to consist of things from Bethesda and BioWare, but is now only Hearthstone and the occasional Minecraft, which gets the job done, but isn't quite enough. So my question to you are these. Do you have any simple dinner menus that you've acquired through the years that allow you to eat and game at the same time? And two, do you know any good games that you recommend that accompany a meal? Thanks for the poddens, Mike." So I don't do this a lot anymore, but when I was a single man living in a big flat full of nerds several years ago, my thing was to very quickly make either rice and something. I love rice probably more than is normal. So I'm rare in that I can just eat a big bowl of rice and that's like the best thing ever. But rice or pasta, like I used to do sort of like rice with eggs and spinach and soy sauce or something like that, or pasta with, I don't know, bacon and a pepper sauce or something like that, which would take me about 15 minutes to do. But basically anything that you can put in a bowl and then eat with a fork without needing to chop things, or mostly scooping, essentially scooping food. And then I would eat this while playing MMOs, usually. And at that time it was the Old Republic. So to link back to the, and that has had a new trailer this week for its latest thing. To link back to the BioWare thing, I guess I used to be able to play those games pretty much while eating, because you don't need to, like, you can just run around and hand quests in and pick stuff up and do action bar combat. You're used to the keyboard shortcuts. I'm really wary of turning this into games you can play one-handed, because that feels like a really separate discussion. But boy, can I play Star Wars one-handed.
I don't know how to feel about that. I used to play a lot of things while eating dinner, because it was just one of the, not exactly perils, but the things of sharing a house was, you know, with just housemates rather than close friends from previous bits of my life, was that, you know, you'd sort of go down, quickly cook something and then just get out of the way so that someone else could use the kitchen. And so I used to just take whatever it was upstairs and play, you know, Dota or whatever else. And so it tended to be things that I didn't mind eating not hot. So, you know, I'd I'd maybe have pasta or something that was equally nice when it had chilled a bit if I didn't die for a while. So, you know, it would sort of sit on the side while I stayed alive. The other thing was, you know, sort of easy to pick at things, you know, like hummus and dip, or, you know, I appreciate that's not a hugely filling dinner or anything. Or avocado toast. I basically subsisted on that for a few months. So yeah, things like that, or sandwiches, like fish finger sandwiches, they're nice. Yeah, anything like that, really.
I'd say on the subject of games that go well with this, you know, we've mentioned on the last couple of pods, but we're in the middle of a sort of renaissance at the moment for great, like, indie, small, like, sort of relatively lightweight competitive games. Things like Duelist and Battlerite, Faria. There's a few of these games around. Like, if you've burned out on Hearthstone, Elder Scrolls Legends is very good as well. It's not a indie game, but it is a Bethesda game. So there you go. There's your Elder Scrolls fix. and that's got a decent story mode, and it's also in its own right a good competitive card game. And all of these games that fit well around that sort of time constraint as well. Cause if you've only got an hour to eat and play, that's like two or three rounds of a card game with a meal, and it'll take your mind off whatever you're doing it after.
Yeah, the other thing is, like, it depends on the nature of the freelance, but it might be that, you know, you make a thing like a pasta bake or whatever that can stay in for an hour while you play properly, but then,
yeah,
you know, you can munch on while you do your other work.
Make a chili and rice all day, every day,
that would 5 times good.
A day. Love rice. Hope that helps.
Mm.
Travis writes, "Hi, Crake and Local Bar."
It's crack.
It's surely. Crack, isn't it? Yeah. So I read it phonetically before realizing what he was saying. You ever do that? How many currencies per month would you pay to access anything, but I guess he means everything, on Steam? Developers get a cut based on how many people install their game in a given month, or possibly how long people spend playing their game? I'm not sure. There could be some interesting incentivization options there. Thanks for thinking, everybody. Travis. This is like an interesting idea that'll never happen.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to put a value on it, because while the idea of, like, people have tried this game subscription service thing, usually with a streaming platform, like, was it On Live? Launched a couple of years ago, didn't work brilliantly, isn't around now.
I thought they tried to rebrand it and reboot it.
They possibly did. I don't remember what happened to it.
Because, yeah, all of the games would be installed remotely, wouldn't they? And you'd play them from your PC.
Yeah, like a streaming video, basically. Yeah, essentially. With a bit of input lag. And they were like curated selections of games that, I mean, it was a service that was top down designed for Tom Senior, because the only games they could get on there were like 6 out of 10 action games from 3 years previous.
Yeah.
But yeah, the idea of, I mean, this, what he's describing is essentially a subscription to a Steam press account.
Yeah.
Which is an absurd, not only an absurd amount of stuff in terms of the value of all the games and things you get, but also an absurd number of different people involved. From the legal departments of big publishers to indies making it out in their first game who don't necessarily want anyone to just play it and discard it.
Yeah, and I think that the fact that clearly publishers aren't happy with Steam's status as a service provider and keep insisting on using their own platforms like Origin or, you know, whatever else, like, it implies that you will never get, I don't know, The Sims on Steam, or you will never get
any EA games on Steam,
you know. And so I was thinking about subscription services for some of those kinds of games. I think I actually said when The Sims 4 came out and you could just sort of see it about to pile on all of the monetized, like, expansions and stuff, I would actually pay a monthly subscription for that game that I could pause when I was you know, not going through a Sims phase rather than the amount of money to even just get the base game and then everything else on top of that to...
This is the thing, like, you'd think that a subscription to Call of Duty, which essentially gets rid of the need for individual new games in the series. There would be new games in the series, but you'd pay your, God knows, tenner a month for COD. And if that's the only game you play, same for FIFA. You know, those ideas are so obvious, particularly for those companies that have these annualized franchises that just keep going and going and going. And in some cases, the only game people play.
Yeah. Or like Football Manager.
Yeah. The idea of us just treating them as a subscription service is so obvious that I think the reason that it hasn't happened is they know that these one-off 40 quid boxes make more money for them than, for example, a £120 a year subscription would. I suspect that's the reason. And because they can both sell that and then sell a season pass and sell DLC.
And microtransactions. Yeah, and,
at every level. So I think game developers have realized that there's no point asking for one small purchase when you can ask for one big purchase, some medium purchases, and some small purchases.
I think it would also distort things in that you wouldn't see the indie stuff that was on itch if you were just constantly mining out your Steam thing. And also there's the odd thing of what it would do to the value, almost. I don't think value is quite the right word, but of games. So for example, you know, if you go through a month of playing pretty much exclusively Dota or something, that's free to play. What would you have spent your, I don't know, to use Spotify's current pricing, what would you have spent your $14.99 on? You know, like, would you then need a rebate, or would, you know, like, what is it worth to you? You know, or if you, you know, got it for a month and you played, I don't know, only a really cheap game that doesn't really.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, so I think this is never, I don't think there is an incentivization structure that makes this worth it to developers of games that cost money. Under any circumstances, because, like, you say you get, the developer gets a cut based on how much time someone pumps into the game, which would seem to be the only fair way of doing it.
Mm.
Like, making that so that it's worth more to the developer than simply buying a copy at the game, whatever price point. I don't know how you do that without the subscription itself being like £100 or something. Like,
but it also means that games that are short experiences, like, even if they have a lot of value to the individual, they will never recoup that cost, because it's like, okay, well, this thing took an hour and I really, really loved it, but this other thing took 15 hours and I was lukewarm. But obviously, because it takes that time to get to that point, you're like, oh, well,
yeah, like, it creates,
they've made 15 times as much, so
it takes the pricing of a game out of the developer's hands in a way that I suspect will never fly.
But like, it would also encourage that awfulness that you get with, I don't know, like Ass Creed, where it's basically like, oh, hey, stay in the game a bit longer and complete all of these nonsense things on your to-do list, have a feather, chase this thing, go over here.
I got all of the feathers in Zephyr.
Yeah, but it's still bobbins that just, like, keeps you in the game for longer, isn't it? And that's the only thing that really would incentivize. Like, because music can't really do that, because the length of a song is kind of fixed in terms
also,
of what constitutes,
like,
a single.
Like, if you really get into prog rock and you start listening to 20-minute metal epics, you're not going to, like, incur a higher Spotify subscription fee, nor a Dream Theater going to take all of your money or Spotify's money. I was going to say, there would be an interesting, I don't know if it'll ever happen, but it would be interesting if there was a platform like Steam, but only for free-to-play games with in-app purchases, and they sold but maybe even games from different providers, and they sold a subscription service that gave you a certain amount of in-game stuff, currency or whatever, in each of those games every month. So it'd be more efficient than spending, like, I imagine it included all of the wargaming games and maybe a bunch of MMOs that have gone free to play and stuff like that. And you spent a tenner a month and you got, like, the equivalent of a tenner a month in all of those games. So if you played loads of them, it was very efficient. If you only played one of them, it was the same, that kind of thing.
Mm.
And that service had a revenue split based on how much time was sunk into each game. I suspect that would then be worth it to those developers, for the reason that when you make a free-to-play game, the vast majority of your players spend nothing at all, and they are supported by whales that spend a lot, or spend anything, really, in a much smaller proportion. If they got to a position where you could be a sort of evenly distributed omni-whale for loads of different games.
You'd be whale spread. Like, you'd be like whale Marmite.
Yeah, like whale Marmite. Or whale avocado on free-to-play toast.
Yeah, nice. Good callback.
Thanks. then that might actually be an interesting kind of way of getting people to cross that threshold into investing money in free-to-play games.
Possibly, although you'd still run into that problem of, like, people want people to use their proprietary games launcher.
And... yeah, but that's the thing, like, trying to figure out the logistics of how you make this appealing to developers.
Maybe
that's it. So rather than say, because, I mean, no one, because at that point, if this is proven to work, no one's going to want to go, well, we need to develop 6 games now so we can offer a bundle deal for all of them.
Yeah.
Then bundling up with other developers and saying, well, we'll put all our games into the same pot and sell a ticket for that we then split based on some criteria. That might work, but I don't think it'll ever happen for
I think it would only happen if someone like EA decided that that was the way to pry some of the audience away from other platforms.
Yeah,
you know, like they do that all of their games for a certain subscription, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, they're sort of not, it's nowhere near the same thing, but they do have their, like, free one game a month, don't they? And so it's kind of like, oh, incentivize. So, you know, it might fit with that incentivization.
I wouldn't be surprised to see some sort of, like, universal currency thing. Like, you know, suddenly they say, oh, pay a tenner a month on Origin and you can get stuff in Battlefield and Titanfall and Mass Effect and blah, 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 you know, something like that.
Yeah,
but I doubt they'll ever want to eat into the money they make from straight up purchases simply because they make so much money from it. Like, if EA still feel like they can get away with charging 55 quid for a game on Origin that never gets discounted, like, you can question their decisions, but they're not stupid. That if that wasn't working, then
they wouldn't
do it.
Yeah.
Interesting thought, though.
Yeah.
Finally, Alexander writes, Dear Crate and Cro-Magnons, listening to your discussion of advertising in podcast 160, it occurred to me that much more valuable than a thin stream of advertising revenue would be data about how players interacted with environments and what adverts drew their sightlines. How else to get huge data samples with incredibly precise metrics implicitly than with computer games? There are already companies spinning up to use VR tools to simulate and test shopping experiences, and then he gives a link to an example called in-context solutions. Why not instead take advantage of existing huge gaming user bases by sneaking test adverts and store layouts into the next Deus Ex? Is this already happening? Have I doomed us to a particularly banal version of the Matrix by giving this idea to our shopping/advertising overlords? Best, Alexander.
I think people do a lot of that eye tracking and stuff when they're doing game testing because it's part of how you test whether an interface is working as it should or whether people are getting distracted by odd things. And so I think that is data that people have, but whether it's data that they could then use to meaningfully do other things. I mean, obviously there's also issues of consent and data anonymization or, you know, all of that kind of thing. So I don't even know whether it would be viable because of how the law works in that area. But I think leaving that aside for a moment, I would be interested in how people interacting with a game would be generalizable to a real experience.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's that thing of there being legit reasons for why certain areas in a supermarket are where you put something you want to shift quickly, or like why you have the fresh fruit and vegetables like right at the start when you first walk in and all the freezer stuff kind of at the back. And so, like, I'm not sure that the experience of walking in as a person and smelling those things and reacting sort of, I guess, more viscerally to their physical presence would be something that you could in any way meaningfully get from a game, especially if it's a 2D thing.
To put it differently, I mean, obviously, like, if you're talking about putting it into Deus Ex, like, inserting the secret shopping flow of Debenhams into Deus Ex or something, to sort of test whether it works, I'd love to be in the meeting where they take that data back and they realize that, like, wow, shoppers really love getting into the vents. They just love it in there.
That would be brilliant. They can't get out. They put all the sales stuff in the vents.
Yeah, they knocked out all of the sales stuff and then they hid in the vents. And then they looked at everyone's email, stole some chocolate, and jumped off the roof.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, how do we react to this? You know, how do we redesign the shop to according? Do we need small events so they can't get in? But do we need big events? Because, you know, so the data, which is never wrong, has shown this overwhelming preference for climbing in them. And if anything, we're excluding people by having events that only just about big enough for a human.
But that's how we ended up with corridors as a human race.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. People got fed up of sneaking through vents.
So it was just, let's just make the vents bigger and without casings.
And then, you know, the corridors spawn their own vents and the cycle of life continues.
Exactly. But people do use heat mapping and things on websites and stuff to work out how people move around in terms of where they click and, you know, all of that kind of stuff, which is interesting, and how they interact with, for example, a front page, you know, where you want to put the things you want people to click on. Mm. And that stuff's really interesting. So maybe there would be a certain sort of e-commerce element to that. You know, obviously, I think people are very much
I just don't think it can ever work when it's not in the actual environment where it's going to happen, because social contracts dictate so much how people react in an environment.
Well, the other thing is how much you are measuring, because if it's a traditional sort of 2D interface like you have with a computer screen, unless you've got a webcam enabled and recording eye movement data, you're not seeing where they're actually looking precisely. You're just sort of, you know, seeing where they've sent their mouse to kind of see. You don't know if they're sort of checking something out to the left of the center or, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so it would also necessitate a certain amount of extra technology in a way that I think VR is maybe more primed to accept. But yeah, I mean, you know, you behave totally differently in VR as in
this is
real
what I'm saying.
Life,
like, even
you know?
In VR, like, no one's ever going to walk into a shop and get like, whoa, look at my hands. Well, like, I could see my hands.
And if somebody tried to ID me in VR, I'd just be like, mate, I don't care. I'm going to climb behind the thing and get the booze.
I'm going
to
make myself really big.
But you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I'm not going to sit there, like, fumbling around for my driving license and then have a conversation with, like, how I keep myself youthful by never going outside because I play computer games and drink wine. Yeah. You know?
Essentially, I don't think you can ever really do a lot of this stuff in a virtual environment, because I think humans are so prone, when you put them in an environment that is virtual and where nothing really matters, to tit about from almost from minute one. And this is true to such an extent that even, you know, Facebook-enabled comments threads of people using their real names that can be clicked on to find out their real employers, they still act as if there are no consequences for anything they do. So even if you put, like, reasonable avatars, or even reasonable representations of people's real bodies as avatars into a reasonable representation of an actual Debenhams and told them, test this virtual Debenhams for us, people are still going to be complete dicks. Even if the fidelity was such that you could pick an individual sock packet off the wall and put it in a basket and then go to the till and buy some new socks or whatever.
When was the last time you bought socks in Debenhams?
Relatively recently.
Oh, okay.
Why?
Well, I just wasn't
unrealistic.
Seemed really kind of specific.
I was just trying to think of a shopping
experience.
Like, is
that just what you do with your time now?
Fine. Well, sometimes you need to buy socks, Pip.
Is that
it's not what I do all
lunch
the time.
Times. Yeah, no. But can't you just wait for Christmas? That's just when socks happen.
Look, you don't want to get on the topic of where socks should and shouldn't be disposed of all over the house.
Oh.
That's a particularly domestic point to end this podcast on. Nonetheless.
I don't know. I think that it could be interesting in some respects, but probably more for, like, e-commerce, particularly given, you know.
But if it's already a website, you're actually testing the actual thing. It's not like.
Yeah. I mean, what was the actual wording of the question? What would they be testing?
How people interact with environments.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. Like, you go into VR Debenhams to test it and there's going to be some dickhead just, you know, who's made a big dick out of the socks already.
Yeah.
You know, like, and someone else is.
Or put all of the issues of PC Gamer right at the front of the rack.
We do that in real life.
Literally. That's, hence.
If you want to know, that's the secret to our thriving print trade is each individual member of PC
Just
Gamer
you
can't
in the
not go into all WH
Smiths,
Smiths and move them
Paddington.
All to the front. We all do it, Pip. It's not just me.
Oh.
I know Phil was bored in an airport recently and moved every copy of PC Gamer to the front of every single rack.
When I was in America, I did pick up the American issue of PC Gamer because I wanted to see what it was like, and it was on the top shelf, so I couldn't reach it.
Shit. So... Can't afford to be losing sales like this. That's why we needed Phil there, because he's like 6'5" or something. Anyway. I think
I think until people behave more reasonably and you figure out how to deal with all of the data protection laws that
until
might
people
get in
start
the
to
way.
Treat virtual space of any kind as if the things they do there have consequences.
Something
this won't
work. I do love though is, you know, once you do start maybe reading up a bit about store design and thinking about it though, is like I can't go into a shop that is on two levels now without like checking whether the escalator deposits you at the back of the store, because they always do. It's just very occasionally something's gone wrong with the escalators and it takes you to the front. But like if you go in, it usually sort of takes you to the next floor but deposits you at the very back, so then you have to walk all the way around to see all of the products on your way out.
Yeah,
again,
I really want more
cool.
shops
I like
to have like proper dungeon design. I don't mean that in a sex way.
A roguelike experience
no.
at Hobbycraft.
So you know that thing that happens in like every Elder Scrolls dungeon and in loads of games, even every game does it to an extent, where you'll enter an area and you'll have to go through a series of like windy corridors and mazes and challenge rooms and stuff to get to the boss chamber at the end. But then when you do the boss, you find out that the boss chamber was like miraculously directly above the entrance, but up a ledge you couldn't jump up, which allows you to get out really quickly, even though you had to go through the whole challenge of the game to get in. Like, every Skyrim dungeon does that.
Like, I'm just thinking of my own boss battles in the Zara changing rooms with how their shirts have, like, really thin arms and I really don't. And so I've had encounters, boss encounters, with those changing rooms where I'm essentially trapped in my own clothes trying to, like,
very existential
fight
boss
my
encounter.
Way out and maybe having to phone my sister. And just,
at no
like,
point do you have to hit a big spider in the bum.
Can you help me? Well, that's a mod, you know, you'd need a mod.
Yeah, okay. Well, what I'm saying is, you know how you get to like the end of those things, and you have this winding, convoluted path in, but then there's always some quirk of the layout that allows you to get out immediately. Like you jump into a little waterfall and you're already back at the entrance.
Yeah, or there's like an exit warp.
Yeah, hence the name I use and everything. That shops need that.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't really want to have to slay a cashier to leave.
No, you don't have to kill the cashier. What I'm saying is, so you know how Primark is basically hell.
I mean, I don't want socks that badly.
So you know, but you know how you know Primark, right?
Yes.
You know, you go into the massive queue. You go through the hell shop,
right?
The awful hell shop,
right?
And then you fight your way and you go through all the different sections and you do that, and then you get your big bag of stuff, and then you go to the till, and then right. You have to kind of like shoulder your way back out through all those same people going the opposite direction doing what you're doing, right?
Kind of, although you're not really supposed to push your way through the queue to get back out.
No,
there's
but
a,
like,
there's an exit that is
no,
like
no but there's a shop full of people between
oh, okay,
you and getting
yeah.
out of the
right.
out of the yeah. out of the shop. What I'm saying is, why not a slide, like a tube slide,
yes,
that deposits you back out on the high street that's right next to the cashier, so it goes like till number 9 please, and you pay, and then you have your whatever your hat and your socks or whatever it is you buy in a shop. I don't know.
Yeah, but you see,
and then you get you clutch your shopping bag close to your chest and you jump into the slide and you are out, quest complete.
So I'm gonna say that you're thinking about this from the point of view of a man who is completely able to use a slide, isn't
yeah,
trying
true.
To corral small children and hasn't brought anything that might be that bought anything that might
you're
be
right.
fragile.
You're right.
But I would also say that shops aren't really designed for customers. They're designed for stores. And so not forcing you to walk out past all of the offers all over again is really not in their interests.
No, that's true. You're right on all counts, Pip, but okay.
I mean, this is why I'm no fun, obviously.
No, agreed.
Yeah, well,
Well, what about a lift?
They have lifts, but they take you to the back of the store.
I know, pricks.
Also, where are you being lifted to? The roof or the basement?
Like, maybe like a window cleaner's lift. You got a window and then down.
But what, you might as well have just gone out of the door.
Yeah, but no, but the difference is this is next to the till. I don't know, Pip. I don't make the rules for the
but
second time.
But you just
time.
Put a door there, surely. Like, you don't want people going out in the window cleaner's
lift. In my head, we were on the second floor.
Okay. Well, I think... Right.
Look, there was a brief moment of time where we could have lived in a Primark with a fun slide. And you're right, there are reasons not to want that. There are reasons for Primark not to want that. But I want that.
Can't you just go on a slide? I could take you to the park. Is that what you want?
No. I'd feel self-conscious.
See, this is where we couldn't go on the seesaw as well. You yes. With your self-consciousness.
I was very...
I'm a grown-up. Children might want to use the seesaw. It's like, well, where are the children? It's like 8 o'clock in the evening. They should be in bed. What are they doing? You know?
I'm just saying.
Well, maybe one day you will be the one that learns how to have fun. Anyway, I think that we've answered that to some degree.
I think that's all the fun we have time to kill.
Shall I try and do the ending of this
Let's
thing?
Land it, Pip.
Yeah, okay. So we have a website. It's creightoncrowbar.com. We have a Twitter, which is @creightoncrowbar. You can send us questions to questions@creightoncrowbar.com. And you can join us on our Discord chat channel, the link to which is on the website, which I gave the details for earlier. You can follow us individually. Chris is...
@CThurston, CThurston.
I am @PhilippaWarr, which is PhilippaWarr.
You almost didn't count on your fingers then, but you did it right at the last minute.
And that's the end of the podcast.
That was good, Pip. That was... out of order, but...
But out of all...
Well, we've got a sequence.
Why is it out of order?
We've got a sequence we do it in.
Did I cover all of the things?
Yeah, you did well.
Was it comprehensive?
I mean, yeah.
Can people end up on the website and then they can come to the Discord via the website and they also have the details to contact us in other ways?
You get no argument from me apart from the argument you just got.
Well... But what's the rhythm then?
No, that was definitely the best. You've done it.
But what order should it have been?
There's just a way.
What is it?
Like, you first say the questions thing.
But why?
Because you've just been answering questions. I don't know, Pip. I didn't make the rules. I don't know why I've said that three times tonight.
But clearly you're the one that's imposing all of these crazy rules.
I guess I did make a lot of rules.
Yeah.
I just haven't really confronted it until now.
No.
Where's my slide?
And if you want to talk to Chris about his slide.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Oh, yeah. Well.
You missed that, didn't you, Pip?
You dropped the ball on that one as well.
I said it.
I wasn't sure it was over. I thought you might have more to complain about.
I do now.
Oh, for God's sake. Anyway, bye. Thanks for listening, everybody.